Good morning, everybody. This is Dave Weiner coming to you from somewhere in the middle, actually in southern South Carolina. Yesterday, at a truck stop in Brunswick, Georgia, I asked for some iced tea, and the waitress brought me this really sweet iced tea, and I said, no, I want it unsweetened. And she said, darling, down here in the South, when you say tea, that means sweet tea. And I said, well, in that case, give me some unsweetened tea. So, not a big deal. Anyway, got an email from a longtime reader saying that he didn't like the audio morning coffee notes, and that he wanted me to go back to writing and not doing the podcast stuff, and I didn't even respond. Couldn't think of a good response other than, hey, I'm not changing. I like doing this. And later, talking with Steve Gilmore, talking with him about the whole idea of straightening out the subscription process and for aggregators, and in the process, excuse me, I'm going to pause for a second. Back. Sorry, it's really early. It's just about 5 a.m. and I had a few things I wanted to mention, and I thought this would be a very good way to do it. So, I asked Steve what part did he said he really liked the last one. I asked him, what part did you like the best? And he said, well, he really liked the song. And I said, I like listening to it too. It delivered on a long time promise that I had said that, hey, let's have some Christmas carols in months that aren't November and December. And no sooner than just January roll around that we got a Christmas carol on the morning coffee notes. So just never know when I'm going to break out in song, and how the hell do you do that in a blog post? Well, you can't. And so if you hear somebody grousing that, hey, they don't like to listen to my morning coffee notes, you might want to just tip them off on that. Every once in a while he sings. And not that my singing is very good. It's just that it's kind of nutty, don't you think? Anyway, my eventual destination here on this leg of my travels around the United States via automobile is Boston, Massachusetts, or Cambridge. Basically the greater, they call that a Bay Area too, by the way, not quite so prominently as the Bay Area of California. And I'm going to a conference about blogging, journalism, and credibility, which is a subject that's like near and dear to my heart, more than I had realized, actually, because as we get closer to the conference, I keep getting all these ideas, and they're not new ones. They're basically reviews of experiences and conclusions that I've had over the years, because the question of credibility keeps coming up. And you know, if you go back to why I even started to blog in the first place, it had everything to do with credibility of the professional reporters. And so bear with me, I have a sequence here. I was a math major in school, so I really like to get logic, inference. I like to do proofs if I can do it. And frankly, I think this subject of integrity does sort of get mathematical at a certain point. And a lot of people are fuzzy about what integrity means, but I think that integrity is actually a pretty easily defined concept. And And so here it is. Integrity is, something has integrity when it is what it appears to be. So, you know, my example that I wrote, I forget which piece it was. I think it was a piece called What is Integrity? I'll link to it on today's, on the January 13th, 2005 Scripting News. So the classic, the example that I like to use is a boat. A boat has integrity if it like behaves as a boat. It appears to be a boat. And what makes something a boat, I think, is that it floats, doesn't sink, and it can hold people, and it can move. I think that's it for a boat. I mean, you know, there are lots of, there are big boats and little boats, black boats, red boats, tugboats, ocean liners. They have all different purposes, but the one thing in common that all boats have is that they float and that they can hold something. Maybe it isn't, they don't all hold people. Maybe some of them hold things other than people, or they certainly, many of them, like a ferry, for example, holds many things, holds things, you know, cars that aren't people, container ships, you know, very small number of people relative to the number of containers, one would hope. assuming that those containers aren't filled with you know, illegal immigrants or Al-Qaeda terrorists. Anyway, I was going to say something really horrible, like, no, I'm not going to do it. There's like, Rogers Caden had a great line on his blog this morning about this site that said the breakup of a Hollywood, famous Hollywood couple was their tsunami. It was a gossip magazine, a Hollywood gossip magazine. And Roger said something very pithy. He said, good thing they didn't use an example like 9/11, because that would be in horrible taste. you get it? He's kind of like digging in there in a kind of a clever way, which I like. All right, I thought it was funny. Anyway, so okay, so something has integrity when it is what it appears to be. So, if the boat gets a hole in the bottom, and it's still, and then basically once it gets a hole in the bottom, it's going to sink, and it's no longer going to be a boat, because that's part of the definition of a boat, is that it floats. So if this boat runs around and goes, I'm a boat, well, it doesn't have integrity anymore, because something fundamental changed about it, and it didn't, its appearance didn't change accordingly. And you might say there was no need for the boat to say whether it was a boat one way or another, because its appearances are perfectly obvious. It doesn't even look like a boat anymore, because you can't even see it. So sometimes you don't have to disclose these sorts of things. It's just, it's visible, it's apparent, you know. But in reporting, so say you have a conflict of interest, which is the second part of my definition of integrity, although maybe I'm beginning to believe that it isn't necessary, although it certainly is a good thing to focus on, is that everybody has conflicts of interest. It's impossible to avoid them. The professional reporters would have you believe that they have avoided them, but I think we can always find a reason why every article you might write, no matter how well you've removed yourself as a participant in the issues that you're presenting information about, that every article you write, you have some interest in its outcome. For example, David Pogue in the New York Times today wrote an article about the new Apple prices. Does David Pogue actually have to buy his own computers? My guess is that he does. Maybe not all of his computers. Like if he gets a review machine from some manufacturer, he can't afford to buy all the computers that he looks at. So, sure, some of the computers that he gets, they're not paid for, but probably he pays for most of them. If not, some relative of his does. Perhaps an heir of his does. So. Or somebody who he stands to inherit some money from does have to pay for the computers. And so when Apple drops their prices like they just did in somewhat of a dramatic manner, Pogue does a good job. I mean, his article was very good. I read it from beginning to end. I enjoy reading his articles. I consider him authoritative on the subjects that he writes about. You know, that's about as much respect as I can possibly give an author. But I'm aware that he's a human being, and like any other human being, if the prices drop, he's going to probably save some money at some point, or he has a financial interest in the outcome. No way to avoid it. No problem with it either. The other half says that if you have any sort of submerged interests that are relevant to the subjects that you cover that aren't immediately visible, like, of course, Pogue is also being paid by the New York Times. So, you know, you'd have to take everything he said, anything he said about the New York Times, with a grain of salt, because, you know, if the paper were to go out of business, he would lose his job and presumably would have to find another one and might have to take a pay cut, and et cetera, et cetera. Most people don't like to lose their jobs, so they generally tend to look out for their employer. Not a problem, just a fact. Not necessary to disclose that one because it's kind of obvious. But if he owns stock in Google, for example, or owns stock in Apple, that would be more apropos because he just wrote an article about Apple. Well, then he needs to tell us about that because he doesn't want us to find out about that after we read an article that makes us want to go out and buy some Apple stock. That has, like, people lose their jobs over that one. That's a biggie. And, you know, you have to assume that Pogue doesn't own that stock. He doesn't need to disclose that. Why? Because we know the New York Times to be we know the New York Times to be a publication that has integrity, or that places a high value on integrity, might be a better way of putting it, because lately they've had some problems in that area with some of their reporters. They had a minor scandal, actually, there about a reporter that did some things that were definitely not appropriate for a reporter at the New York Times to do. So, integrity. Let's go back to that definition. And here's the really disturbing thing, all right? I'm going to tell you a little story first and then draw the conclusion. And it's, you know, some people are really not going to like this. But, you know, let me do a little digression here. I hope I don't forget what that was. But I had an interesting phone conversation with Len Apkar, who was the editor-in-chief of the New York Times on the web. And this was just before the Democratic National Convention. And it was after, like, the whole debacle with over weblogs.com hosting, you know. I knew the facts. I had come clean with everybody, straightened everything out. I communicated. I don't want to dig it all up again. We could do that maybe another time. It was a pretty ugly thing from my standpoint. I really got ganged up on by a lot of people who now, I think, regret having done it. But it was really sort of, it was not a good situation. And had I not, like, been, like, really good at sort of holding on, I wouldn't have survived that as a blogger, as a professional. And then those kinds of high stakes, you know, I feel like I've been pretty generous with my work and my time. I haven't made any money off of any of this, really, and that's the honest truth. I mean, it's been a donation in time and money, and I've not got anything back. I mean, you would think people would appreciate that. Anyway, so I learned at that point that I can't think of anybody in the blogosphere as a friend. Really, I mean, if they're writing publicly, there are a couple of people who I do consider friends who write publicly in the blogosphere, and I think that's been adequately disclosed who they are. So if I write about them, you'll know that I'm writing about a friend. And generally, when I do write about them, I repeat that, hey, this is a friend, you know, take what I'm saying here with a grain of salt. But there really are, like, maybe two, three people like that in the world, a very small number of them. Now, other people use the word friend a lot more I think they use it a lot more casually, or they're more inclusive, they're broader in that. The problem is, and I did it, of course, at one time. There are all kinds of people that I, if you go back to the archive, you'll see I call them friends. And the problem with this is, so I said to Len Apkar, I said, I've learned something since the last time we talked. We were talking about coverage of the convention by bloggers, and which was still to happen. And I said, I've learned something since we last talked. I said, I no longer am trying to be friends with people in the blogosphere. And he said something that I thought was wonderful, actually. He said, now you understand what we do. Or maybe he said, in his typical New York Times fashion, now you're beginning to understand what we do. Which, I don't mind a little arrogance as long as it's... as long as it's like really arrogance. I don't like the snivelly kind of sneaking around arrogance, but like what Yahoo does. I mean, they won't send anybody out to discuss that icon with them except for Jeremy Zawadny, which all Jeremy Zawadny does is poke and pry and whine and try to get a flame war to happen. I mean, it's obvious. I wasn't born yesterday. I see exactly what he's doing. And come on, Yahoo, get somebody out there to represent your point of view, and do it well, and be arrogant, but just don't be personal about it. I mean, there's no reason to do that, and have some self-respect. This guy Zawadny is not a good rep for a company that respects itself and has integrity, and all. You know, be what you appear to be, which is a powerful, arrogant, selfish, short-sighted technology giant, which happens to run some really great services, which I pay money for. So I know they're capable of good work. Somebody in there knows what they're doing and cares. So love to hear from those people. I'm tired of hearing from the louts. Anyway, where was I? So I'm not trying to be friends, and all of a sudden, I see things in a different light, that anybody that's trying to be a friend with somebody can't cover them, because you're trying to preserve the friendship. And so so be wary of people who say that they're friends with somebody at the same time sort of pretend to be covering that. It's better to disclaim friendship and say, I'm not trying to be friends with anybody that I'm covering, and if I am, I'm going to tell you about that. So, back to the question of integrity. See, my claim is that, let me tell you the story, all right? So we were down in Florida this last week I was hanging with Adam Curry and a bunch of other people talking about ideas for business of podcasting. And during that time, Adam got interviewed, got actually a photo shoot for Wired. He's been interviewed like a dozen times by Wired. There's an issue coming out that must have like tons of stuff about podcasting in it, and all of it's Adam Curry, and of course none of it is me, but yeah, that's going to figure in this story too. You gotta understand, be forewarned. But it's, lots of interviews. Adam was complaining about how many times he's had to talk to Wired people, and I said, well, let's get you a PR flack, somebody to run interference for you. There's no reason why you should be doing that. And then he also got interviewed by the CBS Evening News for a piece about podcasting. And in both cases, now I had to see this from the outside in order to get it, because I've been on the inside of this. When you do a photo shoot, they pose you, and it takes hours. They pose you, they light you. They put things in your hands. They make you stand a certain way. They make you take off your glasses. They make you take off clothes, put on other clothes. Basically, they create an image of you that isn't you. How about that? I mean, I had a stark, striking example of that. I mean, Fortune took my picture. I guess it was in 2000, the year the Mets and the Yankees were in the World Series, the year that I went to New York to hang out with Adam, talk about what eventually became podcasting. And boy, they it took forever for them to take the pictures, which of course ended up just being one picture. And, you know, it was a great picture. I looked great. I looked so great that I got inquiries from, well, you can figure the rest out. And then, but when the people met me, they said, well, you don't look anything like the picture. And I said, well, it's not my fault, you know. This is who I am. And they took a picture. I'm sorry it didn't look like me, but that's what they did, you know. And they did make a picture of somebody who didn't look like me. And there's the point. That's the photographic process of... Now, the New York Times did a profile of me in... I think it was also 2000. And they sent a photographer out, and they did it differently. They just said, stand there, okay? And I picked the place where I stood, and he accepted it. He took out his camera, clicked the shutter about 10 times, and went back in his car and left and went back to wherever he goes, processed the film, uploaded it, and the next day it was in the paper. Much better. Much, much better. Now, it didn't look that good in that picture. And I was shocked because it was like it wasn't a picture I would put in my wallet or on my resume, but you know, I think that was what I really looked like. And so hats off to the New York Times. And think about it, just focus. Nobody ever thinks about this, okay? Now I'm going to ask you just to pause for a moment and just think about this. They take your picture and you don't look like yourself in the picture. That's like a theme here. That's like, remember the definition of integrity? You are what you appear to be. Well, not true. Now, my claim is that the editorial process, the standard editorial process, which dumbs things down and takes out accuracy, certainly takes out intent when a person gets quoted. The question isn't, does the person agree with what you have them saying? No, the question is, did you actually say that? And, you know, they're two often very different things. If you take one quote out of a long soliloquy, chances are that quote won't... It's not like DNA. Like, you take any cell of the human body and it has the complete DNA of the whole body. It's not true of any soundbite. You can really make somebody sound like they believe something completely different from what they believe. They do it all the time. It's a common complaint for people who get quoted in the press, bing, because there you have it. It's the same phenomenon. Are you what you appear to be? No, not when you get quoted in a newspaper article or in a magazine article. You very rarely are what you appear to be. Therefore, what does this say about the integrity of the late 20th century? I say we're changing. I say things are changing rapidly now, that the 20th century and the 21st century have very different media systems, and that we're in a process of transition. And what we're going to, what we got good at in the 20th century was mass communication, but with a caveat that we could only do it in a highly centralized way, that you needed to have big radio towers and big TV towers and satellites and studios, and you needed to have a major capital infrastructure in order to be a mass communicator. And the difference in the 21st century is that that whole infrastructure now is basically so cheap that it's, for all practical purposes, is free, and means anybody can be a mass communicator. And that's different. That's way different. And you know, so nobody has the time or the skill to pose you to make you look like something other than what you are. In the photographs taken by amateurs, you actually do look like who you are. And same thing's true in words. You don't get... and nobody has time to interview you, so basically you write your own words, and if you can't get it right, that's your fault. But I can probably figure out what you meant, or I can learn more about you, than about the subject that you're writing about, simply by reading the words as they came out of your fingertips. And I can read all the words. And I can, if you said 500 words to the reporter on a subject, I don't have to try to figure out what you mean by simply reading 10 of those words. And I can read them without any distraction. So the potential is there for every one of us to be a mass communicator. And there's certainly nothing, there's no barrier in the way in terms of cost and in terms of technology. And the tools are pretty good too. And they're getting better all the time. In other words, things like blogging tools and Flickr for photographs won't be too long before there's something like that for podcasts. Search engines, you know, all these tools for mass communication. And the chance for integrity is greater. Much the opposite of what the professionals say in their articles. And so this is a good subject, a good way to approach it, I think, for the conference that's coming up next week. And I plan to do plenty of work before. I have been working on this, you know, actively in my, you know, brain for the last couple of weeks as I've conference has been approaching, sort of organizing my thoughts on. I mean, of course, integrity comes before credibility. If you don't have integrity, how can you have credibility? I mean, you know, that's next. Integrity says, you know, you're worth. Well, integrity says you are what you appear to be, literally. Credibility says enough people. It's sort of that's the two-way nature of integrity. It says enough people are aware that you have integrity, so that you're believed. In other words, you have to have credibility means people pay attention to what you say, and they generally take it at face value. That's a hard place to get to, of course. But that's another subject for another day. I want to spend some time thinking about, well, okay, now that we have a pretty good handle on integrity, now what do we do for credibility? And I guess just one more comment. I got an email along with everybody else that was going to the conference from Rebecca McKinnon, who is playing some important role in the organizing of it. It's not entirely clear to me what that is. The format is a sort of a round table or a rectangular table, conference room style. It's very, very short presentations to get the discussion going, and then a moderated discussion, which, you know, that's the BloggerCon style, and it's appreciated that they're doing that. It's also appreciated that they've told us that sort of fills in a bunch of information for me and now, you know, I couldn't tell from the schedule that that's the way it was going, so I'm glad to hear that. Now, however, I think that in this area, well, I'm doing it in my podcasts. I think that there is a need for, like, there's the ILaw conference, and the ILaw conference has a whole different format. They put like four or five law professors that know about internet law up on, you know, the podium, and they talk for, and you know, for some period of time, and then there's a discussion, and then a break, and they go on to the next one. So it's not BloggerCon style, and you know, and nor does every conference have to be. And you might be surprised to hear me say that. And I have this intuition that this conference, since integrity and credibility and blogging and journalism is such a mishmash, that if you get a room, it is a mishmash, and people really have a lot of very confusing ideas. People who know better say some pretty awful things about other people. They put words in each other's mouths. You know, the opportunity here at this conference next week in Cambridge is to begin a process. This is just the beginning. To begin a process of really understanding where there, you know, what we have in common, the bloggers, the amateurs, and the professionals. What are the differences between amateurs and professionals? And I think, how can we better leverage each other's existence? Those are sort of the positive things. I'd also like to review some of the disasters that we've had and go back and understand why people got so angry, you know, on both sides, and see if we can't resolve it and see if we can't understand each other. I mean, when you undermine or attack somebody's livelihood or passion, what they are, they generally don't like that, and there's been too much of that. Now, with understanding, that will, and with familiarity, not friendship, because we got to watch out for that, okay? We don't want to think of each other as friends here, but what we want to do is we want to have better understanding of what's going on so that what we do has more integrity. It is what it appears to be, you know, more, and it reflects more accurately what's going on because, hey, one thing I think, I hope we have in common is a passion for the truth. That's why somebody becomes a blogger. That's why somebody becomes a reporter. Those are the classic positive reasons to become those things. I think that we've gotten way off course. People look at me and they snicker and they call me an idealist. Well, if you are a blogger and you're a professional reporter and you're not an idealist, there's a problem there. Believe me, you have to be an idealist to do these things, you know. That's okay. There doesn't seem to be a shortage of people with great ideals. It's just a question, I think, we've sort of lost discipline, and here's an opportunity to get some of it back. So my point is that it may be appropriate at a conference like this for some iLaw type presentations. But it's very important that not just be the professional reporters that do this. See, that's the problem. And that's kind of the way it looked until we got Rebecca's memo yesterday. It kind of looked like, you know, there were very few bloggers there, and the, you know, and all the airtime, I won't say all of it, and I don't want to make any statements about anybody in particular. It just, the airtime seemed to be very heavily weighted with the professionals. So the last thing I want to do is sit in an audience and be lectured to by a bunch of professional reporters about what integrity is. I think that I would vomit if you made me do that, because frankly, I think that they ought to be listening to some bloggers tell them about integrity. Then I'd be willing to sit after they hear that, because we've had our noses rubbed in their integrity issues for, basically, that's why blogging started, you know. Had they been diligent and had they been doing their job and constantly checking their stories against reality, there probably would never have been a need for bloggers. But they don't do that. And no matter how many conferences they have where they reinforce for themselves this idea that they have the integrity that we don't have, it doesn't change the fact that that is, simply isn't true. And eventually it plays out. I always hope, and have said so publicly, that we can learn from each other. And I really do mean the from each other part. I go out of my way, like in the last piece, to say that I have gotten a tremendous amount from professional reporters, that some of them are my heroes. And when I was a child, I looked up to them and wanted to be like them. So, you know, when we hear a reporter, say a professional reporter, say that they admire a blogger and look up to him or her and want to be more like them, then we'll have begun to achieve some balance here. We have not, that has not, as far as I know, that has not happened yet. Anyway, that's about it for today. We're at 33 minutes and 39 seconds, 43 seconds, 46, 47, 48, 49. I love this little dance. Anyway, I got to hit the road. My next stop, I'll probably stop for the night before I get there, but next stop is Washington, D.C., and I'm going to hang out there a few days before the inauguration starts, and then after that, head to New York City. So, hope you all have a really cool, great Thursday, and I'll see you again from the road real soon. Bye.